It's bioaccumulated, and so since it's higher on the food chain, the mercury is bioaccumulated to the top. It also doesn't have environmental contaminants, like other environmental contaminants. Mercury is one, but also microplastics. And I know that that's something that's of increasing concern to folks, that we're finding microplastics in our literally everywhere, the air we breathe and the seafood we eat. And so obviously that is an issue with wild capture tuna as well. And that is, another benefit to the plant-based as well as the cell cultured products.
And maybe differentiate for consumers the difference between like pole line caught tuna and netted. If you have to go buy a canned tuna product, Shannon, what keywords are you looking for on the shelves?
Yeah, tuna is complicated. So for those of you just kind of not sure, my background is in an international ocean law and policy. I always focused on fisheries, and I always particularly focused on tuna. So Alex, your question is really, really apt. So there are various ways that tuna is caught. Pole and line is kind of what you would think of it as, a pole and a line, and you're catching one by one tuna by one tuna. The other ways are long line, which means there's a long, literally a long line in the ocean stretched out with hooks separated at certain distances. And that type of fishing gear catches obviously tuna, but it also catches other bycatch, things that are attracted to the bait at the end of the hook.
Shannon Cosentino Rausch. Shannon, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Cadillac Jones and Sting.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
This is Ramona Africa, and you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your dial. KBOO is the exact example of the community taking charge of itself on the move.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, tech house, techno, drum and bass, breakbeats, future bass, downtempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Daniel Peabody. He is a senior gallery director at Elizabeth Leach Gallery in the Pearl, and Daniel is talking about Sculpted Light, a show on now through February 28th at Elizabeth Leach Gallery. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Daniel.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Sculpted Light. This is light artists, some self-illuminated works, and then other pieces that respond to the light in the room. But the two kind of big names that everyone here knows about, I think in Portland, are HapTV and Dan Flavin.
Yeah, the exhibition includes five artists. Probably the most well-known artist in the exhibition is Dan Flavin, a seminal artist from art history. And he is known for using fluorescent lights in different configurations to create a light installation, a sculpture that is self-illuminated and has references to both primary color light and secondary color light. And often you see light relationships in the ambient space around the sculptures, which is really kind of what the work is about. It's about encouraging people to experience the phenomenon of light and how our eyes perceive color and how that affects the space around us.
Mm-hmm. So you have a Dan Flavin piece. It's just untitled. It's from his estate. This is in a smaller room at Lislege, and it's two white vertical, I call them strip lights, you know, fluorescent lights on a sort of white background casing. Then there are four red ones facing up, shorter, four yellow ones running down against the wall, and two green ones sort of sticking out as well, parallel to the red ones. Kind of looks like a little robot or a throne. It's red, yellow, green, and bluish white.
Yes, I mean, I think the artist is using the three primary colors, red, blue, and yellow. It's a little bit of a stretch to consider Dan Flavin a light and space artist, because the light and space movement came about in Los Angeles in the 70s and 80s. But he was really more of a minimalist artist based in New York rather than the California light and space movement. However, he is, like many artists who are really well known in the canon of art history, an artist who did something first. So not unlike many other minimalists, because he was part of the minimalism movement, he was very good friends with the minimalist sculptor Donald Judd, who's, of course, well known for his loft in New York and the Chinati Foundation that maintains his studio in Marfa, Texas. He and Donald Judd were very good friends, but they often used industrial fabricated materials assembled in a particular way into some kind of particular abstract composition to explore, you know, ideas about shape and form. So Dan Flavin is doing this, but he's doing it with industrially produced fluorescent light fixtures, and then he's mixing in colored fluorescent light bulbs. It can be actually quite difficult to continue to get these fluorescent lights, mm-hmm. which is sort of interesting. In many cases, the Dan Flavin estate in New York is a source where you can often get replacement bulbs.
Oh, really?
This is a work from a private collection estate that has become available. It is an additioned work. This, because it's assembled following a prescribed drawing, or almost a recipe, if you will, by the artist. It is designed to his specifications. It is made from industrially produced materials, and it's really kind of the idea that becomes the artwork. It's not unlike the artist Sol LeWitt, who was also a minimalist, who would sell wall drawings. And when a person bought the wall drawings, they would get the instructions of how to do it. Usually the artist, or later the artist's estate, would send assistants to do the drawing the first time.
Really?
And on your wall, or oversee other artists doing it. But once it was, once installed, someone could theoretically paint over that wall drawing and remake it later, and it would still be a Sol LeWitt wall drawing because it's following the prescribed instructions, and sort of the instructions sort of become part of the artwork.
So the piece, it sits against the white wall. So the red, the four red bars facing up are producing the biggest kind of glow on the wall, a pink glow. What I thought were white lights, but they're blue, have a little influence on that red.
It creates this flush of pink, almost lavender light, because the blue is actually quite pale, and then the red is a bit stronger. So it kind of goes mm-hmm. more into a lavender rather than a purple, a darker purple. But it really is about creating this area where some areas look red, but then it morphs, where the blue starts to hit mm-hmm. it, into this lavender, and then kind of more, there are certain areas that look a little bit blue. So really, this work is not only the object itself, but it's the atmospheric light mm-hmm. around the work on the wall. So the object itself is, I think it's like 72 inches tall, 24 inches wide, and 24 inches deep, but the kind of impact of the object within the room is much more like 8 feet across mm-hmm. because of the way the light happens.
There's a big field of green. The two small green bulbs are doing a lot of work. The yellow doesn't really have much sort of purchase on the wall, but there is this white patch where all the bulbs are close to each other. Is that white created by the primary colors?
I think it probably is, actually. You know, it's one of those things where not only were they interested, you know, not only is he interested in, you know, creating these washes of color, but he's interested in demonstrating various visual phenomena, right? So the fact that you're seeing light mix in a way that in the natural environment, you know, we see like a rainbow or something, and it's sort of this phenomenon. But it's really about how our eyes are perceiving what's happening in the environment. Portland Art Museum owns a Dan Flavin sculpture. It's a corner piece, and it plays off that same thing, where one wall of the corner appears to be a particular color, and the opposite wall appears to be a different color. What you're seeing in that situation is the opposite bulb. So the bulb on one side is like blue and the bulb on this side is red, but the walls are sort of the opposite because of the way the light is cast. Mm-hmm. Portland, it's the most photographed piece apparently in the collection, mm-hmm. from talking to someone who works there
on Instagram. I think that's how they measured it.
I think, yes, I think you're right. Yeah.
Which is the only metric that counts.
For visual pop culture, I suppose you're right. Not that I'm necessarily endorsing a Meta product, but yes, I also, we the gallery and I both, and myself personally, we both use Instagram, yeah.
What, could this be shown in a pitch black room or a very dark room? Because you got lights on here.
Half of the room has no illumination coming from the ceiling, and half of the room does. And so it's not a pitch black room by any means. It could certainly be shown in a darker space, and the impact you would see from the light sculpture would be probably even a little stronger.
Oh, yeah. I think. I mean, did Dan Flavin have any rules about how dark the room should be?
Not necessarily. The Dia Foundation in Beacon, New York has a room full of his Totling-inspired light works, and that room has lots of skylights. Unlike perhaps maybe another light and space artist, or a light and space artist, James Turrell, who had very strict prescriptions of how the whole environment should be. Mm-hmm. Dan Flavin was more of an object, and how the phenomenon around the object would impact the viewer and their visual experience. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of any like prescribed, the room has to be this amount of dark, mm-hmm. or whatever.
And you put a white tape border around it on the floor so people don't, like, touch it?
Well, we don't want people running into it. It is a work from an artist's estate, and it is was made in 1990, so it is, you know, almost 30 years old as an
the
object.
The actual components are old. They've been repurposed.
Yeah, the components are from 1990, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's take a look at HapTV's work, which is also self-illuminated. These are three... They look like canvases, but they're lit from behind. They're very pastel colors. Each one has a circle somewhere in it. And then there are these blendings of pink and purple and peach with blue. One of the circles is on Study for Pearl Moon. And it looks like a planet. It's got shading of a yellow and orange and grey. I should point out that anyone who's walked by the Elizabeth Leach Gallery at night and seen the sort of pink and blue lights in the window, that is a HapTV piece. It's been up in the window for years, correct?
And HapTV was actually one of the very first artists Elizabeth showed at the gallery in 1981. When the gallery moved to our current location on 9th Street in the Pearl, Elizabeth commissioned HapTV to make a permanent light work in the windows of the gallery. So they've been on view now. That piece has been on view now for 22 years here in the Pearl.
Mm-hmm. So these pieces seem a bit more conventional. You know, they're kind of frames. They're like light boxes mounted on a wall.
I mean, he is a really important artist historically within the light and space movement, whereas Dan Flavin is more of a minimalist that happened to work with light. But HapTV, like James Turrell or Robert Irwin, he's a very important historic light and space movement artist, which came out in California in the 70s and 80s. So he often talks about them as light paintings or light sculptures. It's interesting because he really thinks the most important part of the work is the light itself, more so than the structure that kind of creates it. However, there are three works in the show. study for Pearl Moon, which you mentioned, which was actually a study for a commission he did for the Nines Hotel here in Portland. So on the ground floor lobby, when you go into the Nines Hotel, if you're going up in the old Meyer Frank building downtown, if you're going up to the Nines for like one of the restaurants or to stay in the hotel, when you walk in on the street there, there is a large piece about four times as big as this work. This particular piece here at the gallery is like 42 by 60 inches approximately. Mm-hmm. But the piece at the Nines Hotel this was a study for is almost four times as big.
Mm-hmm.
I see this sort of band of dark across the lower portion of the composition almost as a reference to landscape. So you're sort of, to my eye, you're kind of looking across what probably appears to be water, to some kind of element of land, and then an atmospheric sky mm-hmm. beyond, where you're seeing these washes of oranges and pinks and reds with this sort of illuminated sphere that seems to be, you know, a moon.
Mm-hmm.
This piece is static work. It is a wood and metal structure that has LED lights of different colors mm-hmm. built into it. And then it has an acrylic membrane stretched over it, like, I can't call it a canvas, but it's kind of an acrylic scrim that helps diffuse the light and blend the light, and it creates a particular visual phenomenon.
Is he using paint, though? Acrylic paint somewhere?
Yes, there is. There's acrylic paint both on the frame around it, but also inside the box. So some of the color is coming from colored light. Some of it is coming from paint that's been applied inside the structure that makes up the light piece.
Is there anything on the scrim?
It's kind of a pale, milky white color. Mm-hmm. It responds well to the light, but creates a certain amount of diffusion of the mm-hmm. light. And it is a static work. It's a piece, I think, this from 2008, whereas the other two pieces in the show, which are part of Hap's Helios series, are from 2025. So they're far more recent work.
Yeah.
One of the things I should mention about Hap is he grew up in Portland. He's based in New York City now, upstate, I think. He taught at Bard College for many years. He also spent some time living in a monastery in Japan. He has a very interesting kind of biography. But his relationship to light is really about the kind of phenomenon of it. The new Helios works are not dissimilar to the structure of the study for Pearl Moon that we just talked about. However, they have a video, an LED mm-hmm. component to them where the light is changing over time. It might go from kind of a golden yellow field around this sort of pearl or circular object, but it kind of goes from this golden atmospheric light to kind of a pale gray light into a soft green, into an emerald green mm-hmm. that then shifts into a pale blue that shifts to a sapphire blue. It's this whole sequence that kind of goes over a period of time of about 10 to 12 minutes.
Mm. Is that just done with LEDs?
It's done with LEDs, but I believe there's also a video component inside it.
They're amazing because, you know, you just stand here and suddenly it's a white pearl on a blue background. The other one is an orange ball on a sort of mixed green background. A different kind of corona comes in of purple. And you say it's on a loop?
We've put out a bench in case people want to spend time with them. The sequence wouldn't be the same always because they're actually not like synced up in terms of the time and the duration of the visual shifts. And so the relationship from between the two Helios works wouldn't always be the same every time you see it. So one of the other things that's a little bit unique about these new Helios pieces versus the older study for Pearl Moon is the structure itself is built a little differently. The wooden structure that supports the lights and supports the acrylic scrim are a bit concave, so there's a kind of a curving element to the piece, where the other earlier piece is got kind of a metal frame and is very static and flat.
Mm-hmm. My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Arts Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Daniel Peabody, the Senior Gallery Director at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery. Daniel's talking about the show Sculpted Light, which is on through February 28th. You also have more traditional art that doesn't have any light bulbs in it.
There are three pieces by Fabiola Mancelli, and they're photograms.
There's these natural variations that come about in the creation of the photograms because there's variations in light. There could be a cloud overhead. There could be no cloud overhead. All these different things when working with the natural environment to create
work. Does this kind of work fit into any kind of ism, minimalism or abstraction? Where does it come from?
I mean, I wouldn't consider her a light and space artist, but she is working with light. They are about the relationship to light, and that's why we included her in the Sculpted Light show. I think they definitely connect to abstraction and also photography, the history of photography, and creating photographs without a camera.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, we're looking at Peter Gronkist's work. These works are huge, and the first thing I noticed was the resin. So you have this pastel, semi-transparent surface, and you can see things under it. And then on top of it are what look like big pieces of wood. They kind of look like driftwood, but they also have thickly applied paint, sewing, staples. They're just very, very strange pieces. And there's a great subtlety in the colors. You know, mostly it's gray, but there's a lot of other colors going on. Also some found materials and printed paper. Do you know how he works? Does he begin with the base color, or does he begin with this sort of arrangement of...
His work is completely responsive to light. The light in the space and the light, that we have directed onto them create this phenomenon where the light is passing through the frosted acrylic surface and reflecting off the color field painting in the back. Mm-hmm. And then you get this sense of infinite space despite, being about 4 inches deep.
Yeah. Is it 4 inches deep of resin? Like a big...
No, it's actually, there's actually negative space. What you're visually responding to that appears to be like some depth of resin is in fact like a layer of frosted plexi.
Oh, I see.
So you visually creating this sense that there's this deep resin, but in fact, there's a hollow space inside it.
Yeah, it's like looking into a pond and seeing stones at the bottom of the pond.
I sometimes kayak, right? If you're out, it's really hard to tell if the water is a foot deep or 10 feet deep because our eyes' relationship with it is played with by the surface of the light. Peter's work is like that. The sort of surface, the membrane surface of the frosted acrylic kind of tricks us into thinking there's this infinite space behind when in fact it's just a few inches of space.
Also in the smaller gallery towards the back are pieces by Greg Renfro. They're cast acrylic, so they look like pieces of glass mounted on the wall, but they're acrylic, and then they have these stripes, these colored acrylic pigments that are translucent because they're on glass. They're on this transparent medium. Who is Greg?
Yeah, Greg Renfro is another artist that we've worked with at the gallery for many years. I think he joined the gallery in the mid-80s. These are polymer and pigment. He makes his own paints, mixing various pigments with a polymer that's designed to go onto acrylic and makes his own paints that way. They are a cast acrylic panel, so the panel itself, unlike linen or a wooden panel or something like that, or a canvas, is transparent. He's building up like anywhere 30, 50, 100 layers of very transparent paint to build up. So if you see, like in this one we're looking at right now, there's this like sapphire blue and this like emerald green. Those are the edges of the piece. Those areas have many, many layers of paint to get to that that density of color.
Paint with a brush?
It's actually poured on. So he often works flat, and he'll pour on the different thin washes of the polymer and pigment, and then he often will shift the object around, and it kind of will pour off the edges. Often, his works, the cast acrylic panels, have these drips on the edge of the piece, and that's because he's putting so many thin layers on that the drips that kind of come off of them as he's making them end up starting to build up, and you get this kind of like rhythm of these little dots along the periphery of the works. Greg's an interesting artist because while they are, like some of the other works, responding to atmospheric light, he's specifically done this. They're not, there is a kind of visual phenomenon relationship to Peter Gronkist's works in that the light passes through them, In the case of these, they do really well on a light-colored wall like you have in a gallery, and the light passes through them and bounces off the wall behind. And then our eyes read them as almost illuminated, but it's because of the light reflecting through them. For him, it's all about color and visual phenomenon in relationship to light. He goes down to San Francisco Bay. He lives in the North Bay, but he goes down to the Bay every day and sketches color studies and then goes back to his studio and paints.
He what? Sketches?
Sketches like color studies, like watercolor or just playing with color and the way the light reflects off the water.
Uh-huh.
And that's sort of the origin of where his work comes from. Mm. So it's really about this observation of light on the natural environment. Mm. And then he goes into the studio and makes these very abstract color field works.
Would it be tacky to have one and put it in your window so there's bright light coming through it?
You know, you're not the first person to ask that. Many people ask that, but actually it wouldn't be good for the work, not in the sense that it would damage it, but they actually need that opaque wall surface behind for the light to reflect on.
Because they're subtle?
If you sort of light them from behind, they just kind of wash out. Yeah. Your eyes, the light coming from behind them kind of washes out the subtlety of the color.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a time and a need for light art in popular culture as well as in the gallery, in the serious sort of, you know, James Turrell world?
We are so reliant as human beings on light, right? It's the sunlight that gives us illumination to live our lives and day. It creates the growth of plants that we eat. Our relationship to light is such an essential thing to human experience. So I think it's not surprising that there's many artists who have chosen to respond to light in various ways, both within the kind of canon of contemporary art or historic art in the case of Dan Flavin, but also within like pop culture. I mean, if you think about pop culture phenomenons or movements like Burning Man or, you know, more locally, Oregon Country Fair, there are always people that are engaged in like a relationship to light and how we experience light. I think cultures where darkness is prevalent in the winter, they then respond by having these different experiences with light, whether it's, you know, early pagan relationships to, you know, bonfires on the solstice, or whether it's, you know, I had a friend who spent a year living in Scandinavia and it was very, very dark. And they said it felt, for them, they felt like the culture there responded in a way that made it felt whimsical and fun. And there were like luminaries in all the windows. And they just thought, they felt like the community they lived in made a response to it that made it a pleasure to have the darkness by creating light or candlelight or whatever. You know, here in Oregon, where we're based, here in Portland, you know, our relationship, like, yeah, it's dark a lot of the time in the winter, but we still have sunlight because beautiful sunny day today when we're recording this. It's not surprising to me that all different areas of pop culture, art or whatever, are responding to light in various ways.
And if anyone's interested in the serious light and space movement that came out of Southern California in the 70s and 80s. Is there any way you can go as a place of pilgrimage, or do you just have to now rely on books and videos?
You know, right now the Portland Art Museum has an exhibition on view as part of the opening of the Rothko Pavilion. They have a small kind of exhibition on one of the floors that just works from the collection called I Am Material, or I'm Material. And half of that floor is dedicated to light and space artists, including Dan Flavin, Robert Irwin. There's a couple works by Haptivian, some prints by James Turrell. So one could go and certainly see that while visiting the Portland Art Museum. There are definitely places you can go and see other works. MassMoCA in Massachusetts has a lot of James Turrell installations. And I think the last time I was there was about 10 years ago. And I think they had at the time 10 or 12 James Turrell installations that one could view within the museum. Of course, James Turrell is known for his Roden Crater, which is a piece that's the large earthwork light project that he's built in the desert in the Southwest. But also up at Seattle at the Henry Art Gallery, University of Washington, they have a James Turrell sky viewing room that's a permanent part of that museum. So there's definitely places one can go. You know, or they can walk by the gallery any night of the week and see our Haptivian in the window on their way to get dinner in the neighborhood. You know, I think there's lots of places that people can experience it.
Mm-hmm. My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Daniel Peabody. He is the Senior Gallery Director at Elizabeth Leach Gallery in the Pearl, and he was talking about Sculpted Light, a show which is on now through February 28th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Daniel.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Brilliant.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Add him on my whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver scream. Can't tell them apart at all.
KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.
Juez federal bloquea intentos de la administración Trump de arrestar nuevamente a Kim.